Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, not only is it the furriest creature on the planet, it's also one of the most charismatic. Wildlife filmmaker Colin Stafford Johnson brings us on a fascinating journey into the secretive world of the otter.
And people have said that they can be quite hard to find, but if you make a very peculiar noise, they will all come rushing at your boat. Now, I do not know why this works, but there's a particular noise. And if you go and bang the side of the boat, if there's an otter troop in the area, they will all come charging towards you, porpoising. Something about it drives them mad, and they'll come right up to you. Their eyesight isn't brilliant until they get up close, and then they go, oops, that's a person, and they take off.
Mystery continues to surround the beluga whale found wearing a harness in Norwegian waters. Could it really be a Russian spy? We'll hear from Helge Sufteland, a journalist with NRK in Norway. And the power of just one tree.
I had a little nut tree, nothing would it bear, but a silver nutmeg and a golden pear. The King of Spain's daughter came to visit me, and all for the sake of my little nut tree.
It all began with a young boy planting a conker in his garden over 60 years ago. We'll hear the story of one Dublin family living in the shade of a majestic horse chestnut.
Hi, Terry. How are you?
How are you?
Very well. Welcome to my garden, and here's my beauty. This is what you've come to see.
This is what I've come to see. It's a fantastic chestnut tree, a horse chestnut tree, and it must be, what, 50, 60, 70 feet tall, is it?
It's nearly 80 feet tall, actually,
really?
Yes, and it is protected by the environment because it's over 40 feet high. And it's just my pride and joy.
Fascinating story that, and I can't wait to bring it to you. Now, wild animals are all around us, whether we're in the depths of the countryside or the innermost parts of the city. But how many of us are actually aware they're living so close by, and how do we recognise the clues they leave? Large paw prints and distinctive droppings are the telltale signs that this particularly elusive mammal may be at large.
Henry Williamson's world-famous novel, Tarka the Otter, is a hauntingly beautiful, sometimes savage story about the joyful water life of an otter, one of the most secretive yet lovable of God's creatures. Now, this true-to-life adventure comes to the screen with a cast of irrepressible wild beings and some human beings, too. The camera's eye puts you right into the intimate world of Tarka and his friends, which is full of surprises. Because unlike tame human actors, they stubbornly refuse to follow scripts. Tarka the Otter, a unique experience that will delight the entire family.
It's 40 years since Tarka the Otter first appeared on the movie screen, inspiring so many people and for so many generations to seek out and observe this captivating creature. Well, one person who succeeded in getting closer than most is wildlife filmmaker Colin Stafford Johnson. Not only has he captured otters on film all around the world, he's been following the first 12 months of a sea otter's life for a recent BBC Two series, Animal Babies, First Year on Earth. Dr. Richard Collins caught up with Colin to hear more.
Tarka the Otter was voted one of the 100 greatest family films. Now, the otter is an extremely popular creature. Its eyes are binocular and they look out at us. So it would seem to me the ideal animal and for the wildlife photographer to concentrate on. He can't lose with film of otters. Do you agree with me on that, Colin?
I do. Just the unfortunate thing from a filming point of view is they spend a lot of their lives underwater doing lots of interesting things. So you see them fleetingly on the surface and then they dive under, and I spend half my time wondering and thinking about what it would be like to be under there with a camera. They often live in places though where the water is cloudy and murky, so even if they're approachable underwater, it can be really hard to film. You can't, because you just don't have the visibility you need.
Well, suppose we were going out this morning to film otters. I suppose we begin by looking at what they call sprints. Sprint is otter poo. And they put these things on tops of straw, and it's a lovely smell. I remember going out to Billy Clark, was very good on this, and smelling these things and seeing the little tracks. Is that where you begin?
Well, it is. I go to an area, if I want to find an otter now, I go to an area where I know that where they are found. Mm-hmm. So an area where that I associate with sprains, as you describe. But then what I start doing is looking for other animals associated with them. Uh-huh. Hooded crows, in particular, if there's hooded crows around a seaweed bed and they're just sort of hanging about, hooded crows and herons. Mm. Both will follow otters when they're feeding, and they'll hang around waiting for the otter to come back. Otters are famously messy eaters, and they will leave lots of the food behind. The hooded crows and the herons are quite well aware of that. So if I'm in an area and I see a heron suddenly fly and land on the spot, and maybe hooded crows fly to that same area, then I'll start concentrating on that. But as you know, they're so mobile. They're in that area maybe just for a minute or two, and then they're gone again. You see them 100 yards away.
Lazarus picking up the crumbs which fall from the rich man's table, the old grey crow and things. Well, now we have, say, found a place where there are certainly otters, and there are otters more or less everywhere in Ireland. They're very common, really, although nobody sees them very much. Now what do we have to do? Do you set up a hide, or how do you home in on the key stuff?
Well, that's quite all right. I always tend to walk along a river. If it's in the river, they often move between river and the sea. If it's on the river, I wander along the river until I find a holt. Sometimes they have a very obvious path up to the holt. Sometimes it's very disguised, but they will tend to have multiple places where they will feel happy to rest up for a while during the day. Around the holts, you tend to get a lot of rubbing, and they'll roll around, so they'll sort of do something that's interesting. Thing is, once they're on the move, they spend most of the time, you know, sometimes you'd see the tracks along the edge of the river. They'll often jump up onto the riverbank, run alongside of the riverbank over certain areas, and then back in the water again. They will have favourite feeding areas. I know where I live down around Clew Bay, it's all about the tide. You have to get the tide right. You'll go out there at the wrong tide, you won't see them. Go there on about half tide when there's enough water for the prey to be there, but not so much water that they have to dive too deep. They're very good at conserving their energy, or otters. They know what they're doing. They're very efficient. But they're hard things to film because you get them in little glimpses. And when they pass you by, you just have to grab your camera and tripod and try and follow them. And as they dive into the water, that's when you make your run, and you make sure you stop before they pop up again. So you try and creep up on them like that, because you know when they're underwater, they can't see you or hear you. So you're sometimes there being absolutely quiet, and then you run like a mad thing along the riverbank, put your cameras down, your tripod down, and then you just hope that they might catch something and bring it ashore.
Well, now, do you set up a little tent to hide in which to peep out at them, and which they will accept in time, or will they?
I would do that if I was around a holt. And often putting up a hide so that nobody sees me, because I don't want to draw attention to the fact that the holt is there. Now, most people don't have any malicious intent, but the odd person does. So I'm always sort of careful not to draw attention to anything. Any bird's nest, most people are fine, wouldn't go near it. But the odd person, they might just be curious and wonder what I was doing there. So half the time I use hides, it's actually to hide myself away from people so I can't be spotted.
Well, now, have they personalities? I remember seeing them as a child. They're one of the few wild mammals that I used to see fairly regularly as a child. My father fished for trout, and I was slightly afraid of them, by the way. There was an idea in Limerick that if an otter seized your leg, he would hold onto it until he heard the bone crack. And fishermen were recommended, but then nobody ever did, I believe, to have cinders in their waders so that these would crackle and the otter would let go of them. But anyway, it seemed to me that there were tame ones, well, not tame ones, but friendly ones, or relaxed ones, and anxious ones, just like people. And are there some that you will find that will accept you, cameras are fine, sort of thing? Or is that what happens?
Yeah, I mean, there are some certainly are more approachable than others. I mean, they're becoming very urbanised. They're certainly found in the middle of Westport, where I live these days. Lots of towns now have sort of resident otters. I've seen them on the Liffey in the middle of Dublin. I saw them on the Dodder the last time I was up in Dublin. It was fabulous. It was a female with two youngsters. It was amazing. In the heart of a city, we can have salmon runs and sea trout runs and otters and kingfishers and dippers, which is something that you wouldn't find, I think, probably in any other European city. I'm not sure. But the Dodder just down the road from here is remarkable. A great place for seeing otters, actually, these days.
Now, you're working to a specification that your person who contracted you with the film company or television or whatever it is, and you have to get certain essential things. Now, it's one thing to catch a nice sequence of an otter, but you must have to get them in all kinds of famous situations, you know, babies, mating, God knows what. Are there things you must get?
Well, I guess it depends on the film you're making. Sometimes it might be a general sort of a film, so specific aspects of behaviour are not that essential. It's a story about maybe the life of a river and how the otters sort of fit into it. And then you can balance it. If you're lucky and you happen to come across a few great things, then sure, you film them. But, you know, otters are tough work. They're all pretty tough. Well, so our otters are tough. I was in America earlier this year filming sea otters. Now, that's rather easier because they spend the time floating around on the surface. They keep the young with them on the surface. So once you find them, and they're incredibly used to people moving around in boats. So you find them in the morning and stay with them all day. That's a very pleasant thing.
That's in Monterey, I suppose.
Exactly right.
Well, now, the thing you would have to get there is the otter banging on a stone. He puts a stone on his chest and he puts the abalone or whatever it is and beats it with the... You would have to get that.
Absolutely.
You couldn't come home without that. Is that difficult to get?
No, it's not difficult to get, actually. It's not, but particularly with camera technologies these days. We were making a film out there recently called First Year on Earth for the BBC, following young animals growing up around the world. So I was following a young sea otter. They just have one young. Most otters will have multiple young. But here with the sea otters, they've got to teach them an awful lot. They've got to teach them how to select particular tools, particular rocks to do their job. Each thing that they eat has a different way of sort of opening it. They might be it sea urchins or shellfish. And you get mothers will specialise in particular kinds of shellfish and they will pass that knowledge on to their son or daughter. They have a one-to-one because they will leave the offspring wrapped up in a little bit of kelp on the surface. They wrap themselves in kelp so they won't float away. The mother goes down hunting, but then she'll come back and be incredibly attentive and will hold that baby out of the water really on her chest for the first few weeks because the fear is that they would get cold until the coat develops properly. Once a sea otter reaches adulthood, it's got probably the densest fur in the mammal world, probably them and Arctic foxes pretty close. So they never get wet. Their fur is so tightly bound and oily that the surface of their skin actually never gets wet. So they're incredible. That really is the secret to their success, so they can survive in such a relatively small animal can survive in cold conditions.
Until quite recently, zoologists thought that it was a sea mammal. There was a dispute about this. It was only in something in the 80s that they finally agreed that it is actually an otter and not a seal of some kind. Well, now, from your point of view, are you just filming an otter as you know it, or are you doing something totally different?
Well, with these ones, it's completely different. I mean, the sea otters, the whole approach is very different because they're relatively tame, and we can get very fancy cameras on board these boats. You know, the ones that keep everything steady even when the sea is rocking.
Yes.
So when you find them in the morning, you could stay with them all day. We tend not to. We'll film them for a while and then back off and leave them alone, even though I don't think we were disturbing them at all. But you just, a few times in the day, you go and find them, film them for a while and leave them. But with these cameras, you can pretty much follow everything they do. You can't follow what happens underwater, though. That's much trickier.
You don't go down.
I tried it, and these otters would not accept me underwater.
Would the European otter do, etc.? No.
Very, very rarely.
Yeah.
Very rarely. People have tried. It's really tough. Really tough.
Mm.
And then other ones. I filmed giant otters in Guyana many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I went out there to make the first series of Planet Earth back in, I don't know, maybe 2006, 2007. And I went a couple hundred miles up an uninhabited river there in search of jaguar. And while we were doing that, we found everything but jaguar, effectively. I spent 2 hours in the bush living in a hammock with a bit of rice and pasta and very, very little. Came back after 2 months without a single shot of a jaguar. Went back next year for 2 months, came back without a single shot of a jaguar. So I was the least successful cameraman in the entire series. But I had great giant otters in the meantime to keep me company.
Mm.
And people have said that they can be quite hard to find. But if you make a very peculiar noise, they will all come rushing at your boat. Now, I do not know why this works, but there's a particular noise. And if you go, and bang the side of the boat, if there's an otter troop in the area, they will all come charging towards you, porpoising. Something about it drives them mad, and they'll come right up to you. Their eyesight isn't brilliant until they get up close. And then they go, oops, that's a person, and they take off.
Well, they're social otters, unusually. I mean, all the otters are solitary brutes. They don't want company. If you're catching fish, you don't want the whole of the village coming down with you to catch the fish. The fish will be gone. So they're social, aren't they? And is this some kind of... And they're noisy, I believe?
Very noisy, very vocal, vocal and aggressive towards each other. If they meet other groups, they'll call, but they'll keep their distance. probably associate too, because some of the predators in the area, lots of caiman around, and a group of giant otters will see off a caiman. The caiman won't touch them. So you tend to have a dominant male and female who are breeding within the group, and then maybe offspring from previous years, things like that, hanging around within that group. And they will eat a huge amount of fish. When you see them here, they're sort of a shoal of fish. They're just pulling out one big fish after another. It's an amazing thing to watch. I remember watching an old lone male otter who seemed to be all have been cast out of otter society. I could not believe that anything could eat so much. He stuffed himself from morning till night, fish after fish after fish. I was sitting in the hide, staring aimlessly at the rock where I hoped a jaguar would appear, but I had the otter for company instead. I couldn't believe he'd eat so much. They do eat a huge amount, I guess, for energy.
When you mentioned the jaguar presumably would stalk a giant otter, would he?
Yeah, but whether they'd manage to creep up on them, that's another advantage of living together in groups. You know, you've got all those eyes and ears. They're very, very alert. I suppose it does happen sometimes. I mean, the jaguar get all sorts of caiman and everything else too. So it must happen. I've never heard of it happening, but I imagine it must happen sometimes.
So there are only 13 species of otter, and you've clocked up, while I'm talking to you, four or five of them. You've probably seen them all.
I've seen a couple of others over the years, but didn't film them. I've never seen a big otter in South Africa. They've another big, not as big as a giant otter, but there's a big otter down there in Central America. I've seen them there. There's another one living in Central America. But they're wonderful creatures.
Colin, when I was young and wild, I joined the FCA, the Forsa Cosenta O'Toole, and we used to have a summer camp on Spike Island, which is now a museum. But I remember seeing otters off Spike Island in summer. Now, I didn't realise it at the time, but afterwards I discovered that otters who live in seawater go and have a bath in fresh water every day. Now, there's no fresh water that I can remember available to them on Spike Island. So what do these otters do?
Well, my guess is that they did travel to it. It's surprising how quickly they can move. When you think of an otter's territory, if it's in a narrow river, it might be 10 miles long or more. Basically, the wider the river, the shorter the territory, the narrower the river, the longer the territory. But a lot of them will come from rivers out into the sea. They can swim all around Clew Bay, where I live, and then back to the river. So they probably were getting back to fresh water. Whether they have to do it every day, I don't know. That's not something I've observed. I've heard that. But I don't know if anyone's ever really done all the work on that. But my guess is sometimes then there'll be an area. I've seen otters those sort of washing themselves on little springs, little soakage areas, just rolling around in those. So maybe even on Spike Island, there might have been something like that too.
Oh, what happened if they didn't have their wash? What would happen their fur?
My guess is keeping fur in really good condition is an essential part of being an otter, because that is the barrier between this fairly cold medium in which they spend so much of their time and their inner bodies, as it were. And, you know, seals and other marine mammals, they have blubber and things to act as a lair between the sea and a way of keeping warm. And they have the sheer size. Otters relatively small, and the way they do it is by just having the densest fur really in the animal world to make sure that the seawater never gets in contact with their skin.
Well, now you mentioned there in passing that you're running tours out to see things like tigers. That seems a very tall order to fly out of people from Ireland to a reserve in India or something and find tigers.
Yeah, you know? I think our last trip was 12 days. We found the tiger every day. And I've got really good people out there. We've spent so much time there over the years that we really know the place sort of intimately. But it's not just the tigers, it's the whole... I used to see a lot of people going out to India and thought, I'm glad I'm not on that tour, because really they're missing out on a lot. So having seen a lot of people there and heard of what they've sort of wanted over the years, I wondered what it would be like, but I'm really enjoying it. Just small little group, seven people, and they come back having seen a lot of stuff. I hope.
Yeah, because I remember me and Ranthambore going looking for tigers in the Cantars, the thing. And it was 4 days of going out before we encountered a female with her cubs.
But you did see one at least.
We did eventually. Not terribly well, but we did see them. Technically, we saw them. We could turn the binoculars on them. Yeah. But it seemed to me that these fellows were tearing their hair out. These are the locals who live in the place and must know every nook and cranny and every twist and turn a tiger makes and have bribed half the tigers, I would have thought. But yet it was that difficult.
Well, I know them so well for so long. I've made a lot of films over the years, so I know all those local lads who probably would have brought you the canter drivers and the guides and all that. But the people I've worked with for years, and I sort of trained up, I suppose, because when we got there, we wanted to bring in a very different... they used to go into the park, see a tiger and say, there's a tiger, and leave, but they wouldn't identify them as individuals and that sort of thing. So when I came to make a film there, it was essential that we knew who was who. And so every tiger has its individual stripes, and we had to make sure that we were filming the animal we thought we were filming, because otherwise we could end up in all sorts of a mess. So bringing in that sort of rigour into making sure that we knew who the individuals were made us learn an awful lot more about tigers too. And now they're all photo trapped and they're all identified using camera traps so that they know when they're, if they're still in the area and that sort of thing. So their protection is actually a lot better than it used to be once upon a time.
How long will these tours take? If I went on, not that I would be in the tax bracket.
About 12 nights. I think that we do 12 nights, sort of 13 days. The idea is it fits into sort of a 2-week holiday. We meet out there in Jaipur and go and try and find, well, different things, different days, leopards or sloth bears or these otters. And then now that they found this otter site of the Chumbo River, we go there.
And caimans, well, there were
Garial, those amazing
and
fishies
Indian
and crocodiles.
All sorts of wonderful things.
All sorts, hopefully.
And the little animals, the mongooses and things, they're fascinating.
Well, that's it. And what's lovely about travelling now without a camera, because when I go away like that, I don't bring a camera. And it's just a wonderful way to spend some time watching wildlife again, which is what I enjoy doing most of all, trying to learn about things and trying to sort of figure things out.
Wildlife filmmaker Colin Stafford-Johnson speaking with Dr. Richard Collins. This autumn, Colin will embark on a tour around Ireland, bringing his tales of adventure and misadventure from tracking down some of our most elusive creatures. The tour is called My Wild Atlantic Journey, and for all details you can go to our website, that's rte.ie/Mooney.